Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Time to look at other stories from other parts of the world. Many of them are perhaps not so good news. Our guide as ever is Jonathan de Burke Butler. Jonathan, good afternoon to you.
Sean, how are you doing? That kind of reminds me of the, what was it, the million dollar man or the billion dollar man who was made out of all different parts?
$6 million man.
You're showing your
relative youth there. That's in those days, $6 million seemed like a huge amount of money. Buy you nothing these days. Right, Tunisia, Libya, we're going to first. And the child of a dead IS militant is in jail.
Yes, there's a very strange story. A young child, 3 years old, Tamim Jaboudi is his name, and he's from Tunisia. And as you said, he is in prison in Libya. He's in a prison in Tripoli, and he has been there for about a year. Now, his parents moved to Libya a number of years ago. It's not clear whether he had been born, I imagine he was, but it's not 100% clear whether he was born in Tunisia and brought then by the family. But anyway, his family moved to Libya. They joined Islamic State, but they were killed in an airstrike in February of 2016, along with 40 other people who were in the town of Sabratha, which is on the Mediterranean coast. Okay, so when the town itself was taken over by various different Libyan militias, the people who were still there, the women and children mainly, were taken prisoner. But he was obviously an orphan. He was brought to Tripoli, and as I said, he's been in that prison for a year. Now, his grandfather, who obviously lives in Tunisia, wants to get him back to Tunisia, obviously, but it appears that both governments are dragging their heels. Anytime they seem to be making progress, the negotiations seem to collapse without explanation. Now, one part of it is some analysts believe that the Tunisians are slightly worried that if they start bringing, you know, orphan children, and there is quite a few of them, about 40, we believe, in total, back to Tunisia, and their mothers start coming back, that there might be a risk of, well, you know, you've got former IS militants or the wives of former IS militants coming back into Tunisia. We have enough of a problem with them in Tunisia already. So do we want to bring them back? Mm. That's one side of the equation. Yeah. Now, the Tunisian government themselves are saying, oh, we're trying our best here, but we're making no progress so far.
Right. Okay. And so does that leave them kind of in limbo, effectively?
That's effectively it. And I think part of the problem is that it's also to do with the fact that the Tunisians might be worried that people might get in through the gap. You know, they might need proof of identification. You know, where they actually come from. You know, and that kind of thing. So I think that could be part of the problem as well. But anyway, in the meantime, this poor child, along with, you know, a few others as well, is holed up in this prison, and with someone looking after him that he isn't a relation.
Yeah, and given the somewhat chaotic state of Libya at the moment, this is not the government per se of Libya that's imprisoning them, I take it. Given that it's kind of up to debate who the government actually is.
That's a point as well. So that has to be, you have to bear that in mind as well. It's difficult to know who's running the show there.
Yeah. Right. Zimbabwe, we're going to next. And the economy and inflation there has been so atrocious. They've come up with a somewhat novel idea to pay for education.
Yes, this was announced over the weekend, I think, by the primary and secondary education minister, a man by the name of Dr. Lazarus Dokora, who said that school authorities should be flexible when it comes to parents not being able to pay their tuition fees. To quote him, he said, if there is a builder in the community, he, she must be given that opportunity to work as a form of payment for tuition fees. So they're basically saying that if you don't have the money, you can come along and, you know, you can help out in the school, the equivalent value of the labour. Now, that's in the cities. Out in the countryside, if you're a farmer, you can bring livestock also to pay for the tuition fees. So I think it's probably indicative of the situation in Zimbabwe at the moment, where the economy, having made a bit of a recovery, I believe, between 2012 and 2014, has again, it would appear, hit the floor, and people just can't pay for the basic things they need.
Yeah, and I mean, there was atrocious hyperinflation there, where there were notes circulating for worth millions of
Zimbabwean
dollars.
Yeah, to the extent that they got rid of it. And I saw actually there just before I came in that there was I think they're taking a vote, or somebody's coming up with an idea to make the rand the official currency there. So at the moment, they're using all sorts of different currencies. The dollar, obviously, I think they're even using the euro, but they'll take anything there at the moment. They got rid of the Zimbabwean currency. I think, was it the Zimbabwean dollar? I can't remember.
Yeah.
They got rid of that anyway a number of years ago. And it actually helped things along, but obviously not to a great extent.
Yeah. And it's, I think it was at one time, you know, I don't know if it was referred to as the breadbasket of Africa, but it was seen as...
In the 70s and 80s, yeah. I think it was certainly in the 80s. It was, well, when did it get independence? 1980. So in the 80s, it was actually doing quite well, as far as I know. And then Mugabe, of course, got rid of all the expert farmers. And well, you know where it went from there.
The rest is history. Yeah. Right. Brazil, we're going to next. And a landmark court case, now, which... could set an interesting precedent.
Yes, because this tribe, just to put it into context, it's a tribe called the Zucuru tribe. There's about 11,000 of them, and they live in the northeastern state, a small state of Pernambuco. And this tribe, as I said, there's 11,000 of them. They live in an area, the contested area is only about 275 square kilometres. So I was looking at it in comparison to Louth, and it's about a third of the size of Louth. So that's what you're talking about there. They have been looking to get their land fully demarcated for the last 27 years, right? So basically, under the Brazilian constitution, they have to protect indigenous land. It's written into their own constitution, and they've been praised for it, you know, massively over the past. The only problem is that they don't always enforce it, or they appear to be dragging their heels. So now this tribe are taking a case against the Brazilian state for not abiding by the constitution.
Yeah.
Okay, so they took their case to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and last year in Guatemala they decided that they would listen to the case, and it's getting into it's going to get into its first month now. So that's what's at stake at the moment.
Right, and what are the possible future ramifications for that?
Well, I think the biggest thing, obviously, I think they're looking for, I think they're probably looking for money damages, but that's probably not the biggest thing. I think what the advocates who are acting for them, okay, are hoping that this is going to get other lands that have been, you know, are supposed to be demarcated, and it'll finally get them finished. So it'll give them legal access to their lands, and will give them protections. Okay, we'll solidify the protections that are already supposed to be there. But the problem is that there's about 340 areas that the whatever the I know there's a particular department, I can't remember the name of it anyway at the moment, but that they have these 340 parcels of land that they're supposed to be demarcated, but they've been delayed, and what they're trying to get them to do is to speed the process up.
Yeah.
Dakota. Long story short.
Is part of the problem here that some of these lands potentially would have, there'd be loggers who would be exploiting these lands, or people mining for other raw materials in these lands, and that's part of the problem?
In general, it's farming. So what they do is they'll clear the land out, and they'll try and put in soy or whatever it is that makes the most money for them. And this actual conflict started in 1989 because this tribe went up against a group of subsistence farmers who were trying to move in on their land and take it. And the problem for the Brazilian government is as well that they're under pressure because they're in this recession that it's going on for a very long time now. And they're looking at ways, you know, to get out of it through agriculture.
Mm.
And the farming lobby are saying to them, well, look, all this land up in the north is there for the taking, so let's just take it. And some of them would have quite a bit of support within Brazil, you know.
Yeah.
So they really need to probably do something. Certainly from the indigenous point of view, they'd need to do something to tighten things up.
Because some of these encouragements have resulted in violence.
Oh, and death, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing, actually, that this tribe want. They want that to be recognised publicly, and they want the Brazilian government to take responsibility for things that have happened in the past.
Right, Thailand we're going to next. Two have been killed in a bomb blast.
Yes, this is two insurgents that were killed in Thailand last week. So there was, I think it was last Thursday, there was about a dozen grenade and bomb attacks in three provinces in southern Thailand. So these are three provinces that are on the border with Malaysia, okay? And they are ethnically Malay, and also religiously they are leaning more towards Islam. So I think Pattani is one of the regions, okay? And that has about 88% Muslim in it, okay? And they would identify more with Malaysia than they would with Thailand. There's a long history there. But anyway, Thailand governs them. And since the 1940s or early 1950s, they've wanted to get away from Thailand, and this is how they've been doing it. Mm. And there's been an upsurge in violence over the last 20 years, so this is just part of it. And the two insurgents, or the two people that were killed, were insurgents themselves. The authorities believe that they were bringing a bomb to a place, a police station or something like that, and it exploded, and the two insurgents died as a result.
How often are occurrences? I mean, I don't mean insurgents blowing blowing themselves up, yeah. But how much? What's the level of violence like among these people?
Yeah, it's pretty high, all right. I mean, since 2004, I think there's been over 6,000 deaths in these three parts of Thailand. Yeah, it's a real problem, all right, and there's no end in sight. Now, the military junta that's in power at the moment, they're basically looking at getting into talks with one of the parties there, but many observers believe that that party, on the they're called the Mara Patani, they've been around for a long time, but many believe that they don't hold as much sway as they
say they do,
indeed. Yeah, but as often happens in these situations, it's the, let's say, the nice party
yes.
that they hold the the first round of talks with to get the groundwork laid, and then lay the groundwork, and then the serious guys,
and then perhaps
jump
get the
on the bandwagon.
And like the other parties, have they expressed any opinion on the idea of having peace talks?
Well, there's one party there, the Barisan Revolusi Nacional, who are the big guns, quite literally, and they have said that they don't want to talk with the Thai army at the moment, but they might be willing to do so if international observers come in. And but the Thai military are basically saying that they're not going to listen to that at the moment.
Right. Okay. Is it independence they want, or would they prefer to rejoin Malaysia or join Malaysia?
I think it's I think it's independence really that they're looking for here. I don't think it's that they want to go necessarily with Malaysia. They're a funny sort of area. They pay tribute to Thailand or to Bangkok for the best part of 200 years. And then in the 1930s, when there was a deal done between the British and Thailand, that was made concrete. They came back into, they were kind of left alone. But then there was a thing done in the 1950s called Thaiification to try and make them proper part of Thai culture. And they rejected that.
Right, okay.
I'll have to come back.
Yeah. If you go back far enough, it's always indeed. Like some colonial power just drawing a line through a map. And that's where we are. Right, Australia are we going to now. And wow, this is kind of weirdly impressive. A 12-year-old who drove 1,000 kilometres.
Yeah, a young man whose name hasn't been given. He drove from his home on the east coast of Australia from a place called Kendal. And he drove 1,000 kilometres. He was on his way right across the country over to Perth. He was going to drive the 4,000 kilometres all the way to Perth. But he was eventually found by police when his bumper was seen to be dragging across along the ground. Now, what's strange about this is that his parents had actually told the police that the car was missing and he was missing. So how he got to drive for 1,000 miles is incredible before he was stopped. But he did, and he's been arrested, and it's likely that he's going to be charged under the Young Offenders Act. And there's three charges against him, but two of them are fantastic. One is failing to pay for petrol. So I'm imagining the young fella going into a petrol station, filling up the tank and beep, beep, and driving off. So there you are. So he got quite far.
Yeah. And why did he want to drive
don't
this
know.
Distance?
We don't know why he wanted to go to Perth. Maybe to find himself. I have no idea.
Or go surfing or something like that. But it's him who's going to be charged. The parents aren't going to be charged, even though they're
That's
going,
a good point.
China's gone, car's gone. I don't know if there's a connection there.
Yeah, it's a good point. I don't know. There's nothing that's been said so far about the parents, other than the fact that they were reunited and that's it.
God, that must have been an interesting sit-down conversation. Right, Georgia, we're going to now, and a political party. This is to do with exempting people from military service.
Yes, so military service, it's actually been around for a long time, but they got rid of it. The outgoing government got rid of it in June of last year, and then the new government came in and reinstated it in November. So it wasn't off the cards for a long time anyway. And this political party called the Pinecone Party, they're calling themselves the New Political Centre, have decided to set up a religious order, okay, and as they've picked a nice pithy name, the Christian Evangelical Protestant Biblical Freedom Church of Georgia.
Crikey.
And they're inviting people to come and join their ranks, and they're going to make them priests. And this means that they won't have to go for compulsory military service, because the Georgian law exempts a priest serving in a religious organization from going into the army. So
they're
using a loophole there to get them out of it.
Yeah, and the Georgian government isn't going, you're just taking the mickey now and revoking their...
Well, the army's only statement on this is that it's going to cause a bit of a problem. So they might have to close that loophole. But as it stands, it's perfectly legal.
Right, okay. And the Christian Evangelical Protestant Biblical Freedom Church of Georgia, one imagines, wonders whether there might be any American money behind that, given their name. It doesn't sound very Georgian.
I don't know. I don't know. It could well be. I didn't have too much of a look into them. Yeah. I mean, the party itself has a pretty snazzy website, I have to say, and has four members in Parliament. But and a lot of the website is actually written in English. So they probably have a bit of money behind them.
How interesting. Right, Russia, we're going to finally, and this is a story about a Siberian teenager shot dead after killing agents.
Yeah, I find this strange that this didn't get further in the in the media. Again, this happened last week. Anton Konev, an 18-year-old in a town in town in the far east of Siberia. So this, just to put it into context, it's 8,000 kilometers from Moscow and about 1,500 kilometers from Tokyo. So that'll tell you how far into Russia it is. So a place called Khabarovsk. And yes, this young man, he went into the FSB counterintelligence office in this particular town. So they're the sort of the follow-on from the KGB. And he shot an employee and a visitor dead in this particular office. Now, immediately, Islamic State were all over it, and they claimed it. They seem to be claiming baggage at airports these days. But it turns out that he was a member of a far-right group, a very small far-right group called Stolz. And there's only about 15 members in it, and they're aged between 17 to 20. That's what we know about them. They're anti-immigration, far-right. But what's frightening about this is that the young man actually went and gunned down his instructor at a local rifle club before and stole two guns and a sawn-off shotgun, and then was able to go from this place to the counterintelligence office and shoot these people dead before he was shot dead himself.
Right. It's kind of hints of Anders Breivik there, though, thankfully. But interesting that Islamic State claimed it, kind of got in there early.
Yes.
How interesting. Right, okay, what should we be looking out for in the next few days, Jonathan?
Yeah, next week, April 28th. You remember that horrible massacre that happened on the beach in Tunisia?
Indeed, yeah.
All those years ago. Well, it must be about 2 years ago. 33 people are being prosecuted in the case. It's opening on April 28th. So when's that? That's Thursday, I think, Thursday or Friday. And so that's going to include six members of the security force, and some of them are charged with not assisting people in danger. So that promises to be interesting enough. Very sad, and that will, you know, reawaken bad memories for lots of people. Jean-Claude Juncker and Theresa May are going to meet on Wednesday to discuss Brexit, and then 3 days later, the 27 EU leaders are going to meet to discuss those talks, and that promises to be a barrel of laughs.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.